Everyone's asleep.
live finally on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Thank you for listening. And my very special. Did I say my very special? Okay, I think I'm messing up like the first thing every time I introduce somebody on the show these days. Bernard Mendez, a former chrononaut, is on the show with me today. Bernie, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And if we're extraordinarily lucky, we may also have, what's his name, Andrew Bishago joining us and on the caller line as well. Andy, can you hear us? No? Well, we don't have him there. And my thing, computer's malfunctioning, something chronically. I don't know what the hell is going on at all. We haven't gotten him connected at all. There's something wrong with the caller lines. So, Andy, if you're listening in, the number is 218-339-8525. That's 218-339-8525, which won't matter because for some reason I can't open the caller line or click anything or do anything at fracking all. Okay. Well, Bernie, it looks like it's just you and me for the duration of the 2 hours. Oh, wait. Wait a second. Apparently we got him. Andy, are you there?
Yeah, I can hear you, Vinny. Can you hear me?
Whew, that's lucky. Yes, indeed, we can hear you just fine, mate.
Yeah, you're a little muted, but I can hear you.
Okay, well, hold on a second. Maybe I've got my microphone a little bit out. Is that better?
Yes, that's better.
Okay, all right. Sorry about the confused, kerfuffled nature of this morning. Apparently, your computer's gone dead, Andy, so you can't join us via Skype. So you're coming at us now from
right. I'm literally in the parking lot of my tech geek in Portland, Oregon. So I apologize, but I got hit. Hey. I've been living in hotels because I'm between residences. I'm not homeless, but I just haven't decided on where next to live. And I got hit at a local hotel. And I don't mean to disparage the U.S. Navy or the Navy SEALs, but what I was picking up on my router was Navy SEALs Wolfpack. And my computer got hit. Everything went down. The screen, the on-off button, internet connectivity. That was yesterday. So I took my computer to my tech geek, and my computer is fried. We're going to have to give it a decent burial. But I hope that's just a coincidence. But that begs the question, if it wasn't a coincidence, what is the Navy SEALs Wolfpack? Is it a real entity? Or was somebody just did somebody just identify their router with that peculiar moniker? I don't know.
Well, the Wolfpack is the name of a group of drunken individuals on a movie series called The Hangover.
Oh, okay.
So there might be a Navy version of that.
I don't know, but it was strange because I was picking up the hotel and then two private routers and then that router, and I'm thinking, I hope that's not the Navy SEALs. I don't think they would identify themselves, for one thing, and then I don't know what the wolf pack is. That sounds like a land crew of some kind. So, anyway, that's the story. My latest death of a computer has occurred. I think it's number 17 or so.
This is your 17th dead computer?
Vinny, I've gone through so many laptops, it's not even funny. I should be subsidized at this point, man, by the state. I've fried a computer virtually every year since laptops have existed.
Wow. Have you ever bought a Mac?
No, maybe I should. Maybe that's proof that the IBM PC is somewhat of an obsolete item. I just...
But we're talking to a number of people about this recently, actually, and I've had two Macs and been running them hardcore, making more videos and audio and website editing than pretty much anybody else in the truth movement for best part of half a decade. Not one problem, ever.
Hmm.
Still going strong.
Well, that'll be my next move because I've gone through a lot of laptops. It's gotten quite expensive over the years, but that's the last one.
Okay. Well, I'm glad we sorted out that technical issue. You know what, ladies and gentlemen, I apologize. We're just doing a whole bunch of tech speak behind the scenes here. Okay. Well, for those of you who don't know, Andrew Bishago is a chrononaut. As a boy, he was part of Project Pegasus, the DARPA CIA secret time travel and time travel and teleportation experiments that his father got him into. And Bernie at the time was, I think, previously worked for the Nixon administration as an investigator there, and indeed met Andy in the Chrononaut programs in this particular, you know, vein of thought here. So we've got them on together. And Andy, you're planning on running for the U.S. presidency, aren't you, in 2016, running
as an interdimensional? That's correct. I will be a candidate for president of the United States as an independent in 2016. And between now and 2016, I'm going to be seeking ballot access on every ballot in the nation. Every state ballot in the nation is an independent. And you know something? I think I have the most potential sort of unofficial party support, in the sense that only half of the U.S. electorate is voting. And of the half that is voting, 50% of them identify themselves as independents. And by my arithmetic, that means that the independent vote now has 25% of the electorate, and the support that is held by the Republicans and Democrats is just what they share of the other 25% of the eligible electorate, which would be 12.5% each in terms of their confirmed support. And so I think that the independent constituency is larger than, potentially larger than, the combined, or it's sort of a 50-50 split between the independents and the two major parties. So I've concluded that Governor Ventura is correct, and that is to say that an independent candidacy can now take the presidency of the United States, and may very well do so in 2016, whether it's myself or Governor Ventura or someone else.
These are exciting times.
Well, I mean, where there's disaffected, where there's such widespread disaffection, there's great opportunity. And I think that the American people are looking for a president who will tell the truth to them. And I have been, and I will continue to do so.
When was the last time the Americans had a president that told the truth? As far as I know, he got shot.
Well, but he also rode in an open limousine.
Yeah. It's not exactly a bright move.
I don't mean to be facetious, but John Kennedy may have survived if he didn't, if he had accepted the advisement of riding in a closed limousine. It's obviously a terrible tragedy, but you know, there's a practical dimension to these kinds of events too, not just the conspiratorial background that we focused on. There's just the immediate issue of how you protect a candidate and how you protect a president.
So, how are you planning to protect yourself? Have you got yourself
a bulletproof DeLorean? I'm going to have to rely on my own marksmanship and my trustworthy Glock 9mm with the ceramic handle, I guess. I'm a good shot with a pistol. That's another thing we should consider, is actually arming the candidates. I think that might have saved Senator Kennedy's life.
That would be an interesting thing. What if?
I mean, in some situations, I think Huey Long might have survived the assassination attempt on him if he had been armed.
This actually brings up a very important idea. What if the candidates were armed and they didn't have a $40 million blockade kind of a troop of gaggle of police and FBI and Secret Service and stuff like that all around them at all times? Might be able to save the U.S. economy a bit of money, don't you think? Andy, are you there?
Yeah, I didn't understand your question. Would that save the economy? No, but
do one little thing. There's no one thing that people can do to save the economy, bar outlawing psychopaths who control the money.
How about a singular tax? How about a tax of about 0.5% or 1% on all withdrawals from federally insured banks? By my calculation, that would raise revenues in the range of $13 trillion to $26 trillion, and the people would be alleviated of most of their tax burden, knowing that whenever they made a withdrawal from a federally insured bank, they would pay somewhere between 1/100 to 1/200th of the value of their withdrawal, as would businesses and corporations and groups of people making withdrawals to spend money would pay that one tax, and that would have a huge stimulus effect on the economy, because Americans wouldn't be working from January 1st to May 1st to make their own money. They would know that any time that they used the value of money to buy a good or service in the economy, making that money unavailable for savings and for lending. In other words, whenever they were internalizing the net benefit of money, they would pay a small tax. And by my calculation, that would enable us to eliminate all forms of federal, state, and local taxation. So I think there are ways to save the economy that one candidate, one president can do, and that we're not thinking creatively about simple issues like taxation. Essentially, liberals seek to tax society to solve its ills, and conservatives oppose that because they believe that a dollar paid in salary or in investment by a private actor, or a business person, whatever, is going to have a greater stimulus effect on the economy, and it's more just in their view. What about if we delinked the notion of funding the government from the issue of it being something that is essentially a penalty to the population itself? In other words, what if we found a way to take the sting out of taxation and raise even more money for government to take care of unmet social needs? That would work a synthesis of the liberal propensity to tax and spend to solve social ills and the conservative propensity to ignore social ills out of a spirit of seeking to allow private actors to spend their own money. So we're kind of in a logjam here in Western civilization about figuring out that question. Obviously, there are unmet social needs, so we indeed need more government spending. I think we even need more police officers. I mean, if you look at a city like Los Angeles, I mean, obviously we have a problem with the police state among the policemen that we have. But in many major metropolitan areas, the American people are actually underserved in terms of the response time by police or sheriff to protect them from dangerous criminals and from crimes in progress. So in fact, when we look also at the number of or percentage of American children living in poverty, we need more social spending. We're not going to stimulate the economy through a tax and spend approach. So I think the solution is to find a creative way to raise taxes. And that's what I'm going to be proposing. A 0.5% tax on all bank withdrawals by any individual or organization.
All right, Andrew Bastrago, soon to be president. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You may not recognize the music, and I don't either. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show anyway. My name is Vinnie Eastwood, my very special guest, Bernard Mendez, and the miraculous Andrew Bastrago. Now, what is it we actually really want to talk about during this program? Because I apologize, I've had a long weekend making a whole lot of music. My brain's kind of not in it, and I'd love it if somebody helped me with that. Bernie, Andy, any ideas?
Well, I wanted to pose to Bernie a kind of an epistemological question about the Mars Jump Room program that we were in. Because discerning whether an ordinary or a non-ordinary experience that you had resulted from ordinary or non-ordinary causation is extremely difficult. So, for example, one could walk into McDonald's and sit down and have a Big Mac, and I think we would all agree that's an ordinary experience, and not know whether one had actually done that as conventionally understood, or let's say had been picked up in a UFO where that life experience was simulated. And I once asked Bernie, where do you draw the line of non-ordinariness at our jump room experiences? And he said, and he agreed with my proposition, which was it was at the level of the jump room, because Bernie was the first jumper to introduce into the debate over what we experienced, the fact that several of the jumps had kind of holographic superimpositions on reality that indicated that not only was the means by which we got to the putative location, which was understood to be Mars, was not only a non-ordinary process, that is to say the jump room itself, but some of the things that happened when we were in country, so to speak, did not correspond to ordinary causation. So, for example, Bernie and I remember going up during the night run with Regina Dugan, who would go on to be the director of DARPA, the first woman to direct DARPA, in 2009, 10, and 11. And Mary Jean Eisenhower, the granddaughter of President Dwight David Eisenhower, was one of the jumpers that night, and another female. At Bernard's prompting, because he felt if we went up at night, you know, some strange things might happen. And they did. Among the things was that my right arm was torn off while we were being chased by these small dinosaur-like creatures. These weren't the large 16-foot-tall predators that were killing our team members and eating them, but more smaller, less ostensibly vicious creatures that nonetheless were chasing us that night. But by the time we got back to our debriefing, that is, Regina and I were found ourselves sitting in front of Major Ed Dames and Bernard Mendez in the debriefing room that was in the sub-basement. It was basically one story below ground at the jump room site in Los Angeles, which was at 999 North Sepulveda, a building that was then owned and operated by Hughes Aircraft, which I think was the major defense contractor that had interacted with ETs in creating the jump room program. And that clearly was followed a holographic set of causes that didn't correspond to ordinary reality. So the question I'd like to pose to Bernard tonight and kind of explore, one of the questions I'd like to explore is, how do we know that the non-ordinariness began there at the level of the jump room? Maybe it began at our training. Because, for example, you may recall that when I was on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie back in November of 2011 with one of our fellow U.S. chrononauts, William B. Stillings, Major Dames called in and denied that he was our training officer. And yet, Brett Stillings and Bernard Mendez and I agree that a Major Ed Dames, who looks exactly like the one that's in our contemporary reality and identified himself as such, was clearly our training officer at College of the Siskiyous in summer of 1980. But Ed denies it. And when you're talking about non-ordinary claims, I mean, it's preposterous not to entertain the challenges to the epistemology of what happened that are posed by people that you're placing in the set of experiences. I mean, it just basic fairness requires that when you make a set of non-ordinary claims, such as we have, you have to respect the opposition that you get from people that you're implicating in these events. And certainly Ed Dames is implicated by the three of us. We all agree that he was our instructor. Well, this Ed Dames is denying it. And so the question I'd like to pose to Bernie is, Bernie, what evidence do we have that, let's say, we didn't, you know, we kind of crossed over into the threshold of non-ordinariness right at the inception of the time that each of us was introduced to the fact that we were going to be trained to go to Mars. In other words, much earlier in our set of experiences.
I don't know how to answer that exactly. I know Ed Dames is the instructor. Why he's denying it, I don't know. I think he's got a vow of confidentiality, the money, not to speak about these things.
Wouldn't you be bound by national security or something of that nature if you're involved in classified programs? You'd be bound to not say anything?
Well, he was a career officer, yep. So he was bound not to say anything. He's just denying it. He doesn't want to get involved in the controversy of it all.
Yeah, if you had a financial interest, for example, Vinny, but some of us weren't paid. And this is actually another issue that Bernard and William and I are raising. We haven't gone public primarily for monetary reasons. But anybody who provides labor has a laborer's claim to the to their wages. I mean, that's a biblical principle, right? In fact, employers are under Scripture, if you want to identify the Bible as basically the primary law or the original law of Western civilization, an employer is supposed to pay a workman's wages by nightfall. Well, it's been over 30 years for us, and Uncle Sam failed to pay us, or somebody in the program basically stole our salary, which would have been very easy in the secret project context, because those who were supervising these projects can tell the federal government, yes, you know, these individuals are secretly involved, just send us the money and we'll disperse it here. All I remember receiving is a few very small checks from a U.S. agency called the Department of Naval Intelligence, and that's to be distinguished from the Office of Naval Intelligence. And the only other place I've been able to find that agency identified is in the story told by Robert Lazar, of all people. He stated that the Department of Naval Intelligence was involved in supervising his exposure to extraterrestrial craft at Area 51. That's the only other place I can find it. But Brett Stillings and I remember receiving exceedingly small checks, like $34, $55, a couple times when we were serving the Jump Room program. So in addition to exploring these issues of causation, and I think you just saw in Bernie's answer that we agree that Ed Dames was our instructor. It certainly was something, it was either him or something creating the effect of being Ed Dames. But another issue is that we're not bound to the enlightened self-interest of violating any oath of secrecy or loyalty that we signed because we were cheated of our salary. And I don't think it's equitable for us to owe an oath of fealty to a government that cheated us of our salary. I mean, in a really a condign denial of a basic human right, which is to be paid your wages as a laborer. And as I said, I think that's counter to the Judeo-Christian ethos that supposedly informs Western civilization. Under the U.S. Constitution, nobody, whether it's the government or a private actor, can subject another human being to slavery or involuntary servitude. Now, we weren't enslaved, but I think in a situation where where peer pressure was used to compel us to agree to sign the oath of secrecy, in a situation where we were then denied our wages because it was either stolen, they were either stolen or never paid, I don't think we owe the government an oath of fealty, and we don't have any enlightened self-interest not to talk at this point. We were cheated of salary benefits. Bernard remembers being told that all of us were going to be involved in the so-called revolving door, which is a kind of perquisite that if you work in a government project, secret or otherwise, sometimes people are guaranteed later employment with the government. So we were denied everything. We weren't even medically monitored. You know, here we were going to either Mars or some environment that modeled Mars and was clearly off-planet. I think we all agree that we were going off-planet, and we were told it was Mars. We've been presupposing it was Mars. And after we were subjected to that new experimental and dangerous, potentially dangerous energy field of going there, you know, and experiencing the nauseating effect of the elevator twisting from a box-like structure into a cylinder, and then it correcting itself, and us, disembarking on non-Earth soil, we weren't even medically monitored. And so I think it's critical that we speak out. You know, I've analogized between the abolition movement that led up to the U.S. Civil War being a matter of opposing slavery as a form of physical bondage, and then I analogized to the truth movement as sort of the abolition movement of our time, opposing state secrecy and trying to overturn the metaphysical bondage, metaphysical oppression that it entails. But there's a direct analogy here, and that is that like slaves and indentured servants, we were asked to serve the most powerful, the wealthiest country in the world at that time, and America may have slipped a couple pegs since then. In terms of financial well-being, but nonetheless, we were cheated of any salary or benefit for the noble and courageous service that we gave, and that was fundamentally unjust. And that's, I think, we would be less than forthcoming with the truth if we concealed the fact that we're angry, that we weren't paid or benefited in any way, as we would have been if we had served in the conventional service, and we weren't medically monitored or insured for our project-related injuries.
And has there been a swath of illness or accidents and so on and so forth that has beheld Chrononauts both in and outside of operations?
There has been. I mean, I've already spoken with one of the team leaders from Project Pegasus. In June of 2003, working through a history professor at a Texas college, I was put in touch with the Central Intelligence Agency. And for about 10 days in early June of 2003, 10 years ago, I met with a group of people in one-on-one briefings in different locations in northern New Mexico and southwest Colorado. And I was told during those meetings by Jack Pruitt, who had been a team leader on Project Pegasus, that it was believed that the energy source that the Tesla teleportation was using to send us to distant locations in time and space, and that was just that would be the radiant energy upon which teleportation is based, that Tesla teleportation or Vortal teleportation is based, was believed to have damaged the system of metabolic regulation in the child teleportees, so that many of those individuals were developing a type 2 diabetes like syndrome in adulthood. And I have that. He also stated that the adult participants were developing heart valve defects. And in fact, when my father had his first of two open heart surgeries, this being at Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Beverly Hills in 1978, his cardiac surgeon came out and asked us how he could have developed the defect to his mitral valve that he had. The mitral valve was essentially fused like a butterfly's wing when it should not have been, so that it could flap open and shut. And it was actually replaced with a St. Jude's cuff that my dad had in his chest for the last 13 years of his life, until his death in 1990. So the project participants, some of whom were wittingly and willingly serving like my father, others of us who had been compelled to serve by the Department of Defense, usually with the permission of the father of the child, were injured. And none of those injuries are covered under the GI Bill of Rights. We were never medically insured. And I don't think it's just to cause some citizens to internalize the defense costs of a nation, a particularly a wealthy and powerful nation like the United States. So that's, you know, I have to be frank and say that that's another thing that's compelling us to speak out, is that we weren't just cheated of salary and things like medical benefits. If we'd been covering the GI Bill of Rights, we would have been entitled to educational, dental, medical, and burial benefits, and in some cases, employment assistance. But we weren't, and we've been forced to internalize the cost of our medical care, which is beyond what our costs would have been if we had never served. I just think that's fundamentally unjust, and I think that that's something that should anger the American people, that after state secrecy was enshrined as the central operating principle of the U.S. Department of Defense, basically the military-industrial complex to include the intelligence community, not just the defense community per se, thousands of Americans were compelled to serve without salary or benefits. And that's one of the things we're fighting to rectify.
Indeed, and I think that's a well mission as well, because one thing occurs to me, it wouldn't just be people in Project Pegasus that are having all these benefits denied and so on and so forth, would it? There'd actually be quite a few different black bags, secret operations and experiments and so on and so forth operating all over the place that nobody knows about, and certainly nobody gets to hear from the victims to fight for their rights to get frickin' paid. We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, with Andrew Brashago and Bernard Mendez. Don't you worry, folks. back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week for your listening pleasure. My very special guests are Andrew Brashago and Bernard Mendez. And Bernard, I wanted to ask you, what did you think about my statement there, wondering, considering the jumpers were denied their benefits and so on and so forth? I thought they could probably get away with it because it was a black op, maybe. Do you know if this has kind of happened before to other people in other areas?
Well, I don't know if it's happened anywhere else it has happened, but I'm sure it has.
Where there's smoke, there's fire.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a lot of people, I know a lot of people who work for Howard Hughes were complaining they weren't getting paid either. Hughes never paid a lot of his people.
Well, so this is a particular type of guy who runs operations and notorious for not paying his people, you say?
It's true.
Well, then it might be an interesting idea to actually look into this person's particular background and see what other projects he was involved in. You might have a massive class action lawsuit on your hands.
Right, well, it's hard to prove it when the GAO don't recognize what you've done.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's one of the reasons that these deprivations of our salary and benefits occurred, because they were creating corporate cutouts for intelligence operations a la Iran-Contra. So individuals like Howard Hughes were essentially sort of super operatives for the U.S. intelligence community. They weren't simply the seemly managers of defense contractors. They were basically CIA operatives, senior CIA personnel with tremendous power and essentially independent control over the operations that they had purview over. So when you're dealing with somebody who was dedicated on a lifetime basis to becoming a wealthy and powerful industrialist like Howard Hughes, how could the U.S. government believe that he would do something with the decency, the basic decency of paying his personnel? You know, they were operating in a realm of secrecy where they had tremendous ambit over what was going on without oversight by Congress. They had placed these types of operations into corporate cutouts to cut out the American people's representatives, namely Congress. And in the process, they enabled individuals like Howard Hughes to become even more famously wealthy because they were being paid our salaries and we weren't being paid our salaries. And then they made it seem as if we had been paid, I guess by seeing that the Department of Naval Intelligence, whatever that was probably some kind of proxy for the CIA, to send us a few de minimis checks as if we were on salary. But to the extent that we served for years at the risk of our own lives, it's just ludicrous the tiny amounts we were paid. So I think that those were stolen by the wealthy private industrialists that were retained by the U.S. intelligence community to keep these kinds of projects from being under the oversight authority of the U.S. Congress. And yes, so the lawsuit potentially would be against the private corporation involved. It would basically, we would overcome the problem of sovereign immunity by going directly at the private corporations that were handling these operations. And they would be free then to, what, they would begin burning records and deleting digital files to deny that they had ever had responsibility over such projects. But then again, that's why I think we have to give due strength to the corroborating testimony of individuals like William Stillings and Bernard Mendez and myself. You know, we're three individuals living in different states from different backgrounds, and we've corroborated extremely small details about our jump room experiences. Some of which were together, and we were trained together. Some of the jumps were together. And that's why I think that, in evidential terms, that kind of testimony has to be given weight, because there's just too much leeway for the private defense contractors involved to conceal the existence of the projects while taking our salary. And I think that kind of behavior exploded during the Reagan years. I was once told by Jean Maria Arrigo, Dr. Jean Arrigo, the ethicist who's worked extensively with CIA and the military, the U.S. military, that as a matter of course, operators are paid, but not operatives. being an operative is essentially a debased currency in the intelligence community, because it basically means to the insiders that you're an outsider who's manipulated into believing that you're an insider and then never paid. She said to me one time, point blank, operatives are never paid. And if you look at the mind control area, you know, in mind control, we focused on the invasion of civil liberties, just in the mere fact that the functioning of people's minds was invaded by mind control techniques. We've looked at the injustice of using people as instruments of agency for state actions that were themselves criminal in some cases. But one thing we haven't emphasized in the mind control area is that you don't have to pay people who you used mind control to put into motion operationally. In many cases, they weren't even aware that they served. So, for example, the Candy Jones type operative, where somebody was hypnotized and then given information to transmit to somebody else and then used in that manner and then taken out of that altered state with hypnosis, ultimately not remembering that they were being used as an errand like that until years later, all those people were basically couriers who in any ordinary instance would have been paid for carrying information from point A to point B or from person A to person B. And yet mind control enabled the U.S. intelligence community and Defense Department and its private contractors to deny those people salary and benefits because in many cases they weren't even aware that they were serving.
Might have saved an awful lot of money. Imagine an entire giant secret operation with many, many different projects, huge quantities of different technologies and schemes, and nobody even has to get paid.
Right, and they were viewing that as a means of winning the Cold War, right? Because any time they could amplify the efficacy, you know, increase the efficacy of their operations with the budget that they had, they were that far ahead of the former Soviet Union. You know, so at the time that the U.S. was patting itself on the back of how free we were and how different we were from the former Soviet Union and how our society wasn't infiltrated by intelligence agents in the way that the KGB was. In fact, we had more intelligence agents, and they were more regularly denying people civil liberties to complete operations. In fact, you may recall that in the early 70s, many engineers were moved from the East Coast to Southern California. During my research, I put together a pattern where it looked like the U.S. government was actually putting particular engineers and specialists in different areas of defense technical activity on the same streets in Southern California so that they could communicate about their work, for example, during the weekend. So, you know, that's something by which we can sort of adjust our thinking about how un-Soviet the United States actually was during those years. In fact, we were doing the same kinds of things that the former Soviet Union was doing, but we were doing them more effectively.
Now, did not the United States actually employ people who were the former heads of the KGB to come in and set up the way Homeland Security was being run?
Well, yes, but even before then, you know, we didn't have a gulag, but my point is that at the very time during the Reagan-Bush years, during which we were congratulating ourselves that we would and then did win the Cold War under ostensibly a freer model of society. In fact, the U.S. intelligence community was simply being more effective than the KGB. Instead of having to torture people, they were able to open people's minds up with pharmaceuticals. Instead of literally regimenting society with the KGB, they were doing casual things like just making sure that engineers and other specialists in certain areas of defense technical development were simply made neighbors so they could collaborate during the weekend. So there was extensive planning in this area, and none of the whys and the wherefores of what happened to American society under these Cold War pressures is even discussed at this point. I mean, I went to a high school in Southern California where virtually every other student's father was an engineer working for some defense technical agency, defense contractor, or alphabet soup intelligence agency. And so, you know, there's a question for history. Why did the United States move its whole defense technical class to an earthquake-prone area from the East Coast in the early 70s? I think that's a question for history that's never even addressed. There was a huge migration of federal employees to the Los Angeles Basin beginning in around 1971, 72, the very time that I was leaving Pegasus. So what did they detect that caused them to move all of those personnel to and all of those headquarters and so forth to Southern California? Was it just the sunshine? You know, did they consider the fact that they were moving all those defense contractors to an earthquake-prone region? Why did they move all those companies?
Well, it's a mystery, isn't it? And we'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen. Bernard Mendez and Andrew Brashago are my very special guests. We've got them for another whole hour, so sit tight. Don't you go anywhere, and please, if you can, go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and subscribe for $5 a month to support the broadcast or donate. We'll be right back, folks. Ladies and gentlemen, it is now hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide. Because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. And my very special guests are Andrew Brashago and Bernard Mendez. So, using people in a slave manner, let's think about this. If you're working and you're not being paid and you don't really have much of a choice in it, is that like pretty much exactly what slavery is, do you think, Andrew?
Well, it doesn't involve all the attributes of slavery. The badges and incidents of slavery that were outlawed in the Civil War amendments, as well as slavery and involuntary servitude themselves. But there's no doubt that, you know, I mentioned how the 13th Amendment that outlawed slavery and involuntary servitude in the United States is the only amendment to the U.S. Constitution where there is not a state action requirement. In other words, it forbids private citizens and private enterprises from doing so as well. So the individuals working for the defense contractors, the defense contractor corporations themselves, were engaging in constitutionally forbidden action in absence of any state action requirement, when they were conscripting Americans, young and old, into these Cold War defense projects and not paying them. It was illegal. And, you know, we have focused on a lot of other issues, the question of abusive power by the CIA, the use of mind control to manipulate people, the creation of a breakaway civilization in which a priesthood of insiders is in possession of the secrets of the inner sanctum of the government, the defense secrets, the defense technical secrets, utilizing technology that the general public would consider being from the realm of science fiction. But in a simple, under a simple social justice-based analysis of what was happening, the reason I'm surfacing it now is that, you know, there's been a healthy debate in American society. We had a very strong labor movement. I would cite Boyer's Labor's Untold Story for really the true story of the American labor movement. And we've ignored the fact that one of the principal abuses that was occurring by the Defense Department in the United States, its defense contractors, and the intelligence community during the Cold War in the context of these projects was essentially exploiting labor by not paying the participants. It was unconstitutional for that to have happened. I don't know if it was slavery, because we didn't have all of the badges and incidents of slavery. I mean, we could engage in the regular freedoms, you know, the freedom to utilize the First Amendment, you know, our First Amendment rights to freedom, speech, assembly, religion. We could marry, you know, we had the right to travel interstate and so forth. So all of our liberties weren't suspended, but nonetheless, we were definitely subjected to involuntary servitude when we were called to report to certain locations where our training began and where peer pressure was used to persuade us to sign the secrecy oath. And there was some discussion, and this isn't just occurring in a void. I mean, my father was told that the children, the participants in Project Pegasus, were going to be paid $30,000 in 1972 dollars that were going to be placed in trust and invested and managed until their 25th birthdays, which for me would have been September 18th of 1986. And when we went over to the Army Adjutant's office at the Curtis Wright Building in Woodridge, New Jersey, where the teleport was, my father and the Army Adjutant found themselves in about an hour shouting match in his office about the fact that a determination would be made, or had been made, that I would not be paid my compensation in trust at all. It would not be vested in the trust, because they had determined that in the future I would become a whistleblower and somebody who would seek to undermine the secrecy of the project. So here, time travel itself was utilized to identify me as essentially, if not an enemy of the state, somebody who was going to breach the secrecy and loyalty agreement that they had me sign in October of 1969, when I had just turned 8 years old. Well, again, under the U.S. Constitution, children lack the capacity to contract, and under, you know, abiding U.S. law, they lack the capacity to contract. So I'm not bound by that secrecy oath that I signed in October of 69 as an 8-year-old. But nonetheless, there's an example where, you know, we have evidence that there was an intent, and the parents were often told that child participants in these defense projects would be paid, but decisions were made to literally not pay people. So I don't think it was enslavement per se, but it was definitely, there was an aspect of involuntary servitude in the sense that we weren't asked whether or not we would agree to serve. We were just called to certain locations and immersed in specialized training that led right into operations. And then the deceit was used in some cases to deny compensation. So I think that's the kind, you know, the form of, one of the forms of involuntary servitude that the Civil War amendments were addressing, to just correct the labor situation after the Civil War, not just prohibiting the enslavement of fellow human beings, but also the exploitation of laborers. And in involuntary servitude by individuals like indentured servants, there were not only Caucasian slaves in the United States, but many whites from Europe came to the United States under contracts of indentured servitude. And so that's what I think the 13th Amendment was addressing. It was a broader class than the recently emancipated black slaves in the United States. It also included poor whites who were regularly being cheated and essentially indentured for life as a result of the contracts they had signed to come to the United States. So I find it execrable that at the zenith of its power and influence and wealth, the government of the United States, at a time when it was enriching already wealthy industrialists like Howard Hughes and Ralph Parsons and Stephen Bechtel, was literally taking American schoolchildren like myself or teenagers like Brett and I, 10 years later during the Jump program, and basically indenturing us in programs in which we could have lost our lives. I just find that morally execrable And that was one of the things, in fact, that motivated me to breach the oaths of loyalty and secrecy that I did sign and come forward as a whistleblower.
I think that's fair and just. If somebody has no loyalty or faith towards you, why should it be returned? It should be a reciprocal relationship, correct? Based on respect.
Well, yes. I mean, again, ostensibly, an abiding value of whatever you want to define what guides contemporary life in the West, let's say the Judeo-Christian value, would be the notion that we live under a social contract where people can't be exploited individually to ensure group well-being. I mean, we pay and benefit the lowliest laborers in the military, somebody who might spend their 2 or 4 or 8 year career swabbing the deck of an aircraft carrier. I mean, we don't refuse to pay them because they're not an admiral or because the labor that they performed was humble but necessary service. But in the area of these secret projects, they did so regularly. It happened to me twice. I gave 8 years of unsalaried, unbenefited labor to the United States Department of Defense. And when I went in search of what happened to me, I was denied any... even the secret degree that I earned when I was earning my BA in history overtly at UCLA. I was taking a night school program that's been taught at UCLA by the... It's been administered by the Naval Postgraduate School at UCLA since World War II, and it's a 3-year class that you audit in different aspects of strategic intelligence, and it enrolled not just naval ROTCs but mainstream students from history and political science and economics, because they had identified individuals that they would bring into naval intelligence and accelerate to the lieutenant commander rank in the event of a world war. Let's say the Soviet Army marched into Western Europe. They knew that they had a human resource deficit where they'd have to create a lot of naval intelligence officers really quickly, and then hence they would have to bring individuals from the civilian sector into the military. Okay, so I earned a second degree when I was earning my history degree. It was reviewed when I had my exit interview with my counselor at the College of Letters and Science at UCLA. We were instructed to deny that the degree existed and to state that the only reason it existed on our cumulative record was as the result of a computer glitch. And I basically gave away a BS in advanced math, which is how it was listed on my cumulative record, as instructed. When I went in search of that degree, the Naval Postgraduate School at UCLA would not even talk to me. Okay, so again, this is part of the lack of transparency and equity that I hope to confront as President of the United States. The United States was founded under the doctrine that just government only exists with the consent of the governed. And this combination of state tyranny and secrecy has prevented even individuals who have served the United States government in dangerous capacities from even communicating with the government about their service. And that has to change. That is tyranny, per se. It's as tyrannical as anything that the Soviet Union imposed upon Soviet military or intelligence forces, maybe with the exception of the fact that we didn't have a gulag where individuals were being sent to Siberia or to, you know, forced labor camps or imprisonment.
I can correct you there, Andy. You've heard of Guantanamo Bay?
Well, we have Guantanamo for foreign combatants, and we've had an even more serious deprivation, literally of physical liberty. So I don't want to avoid the moral dilemma of that, and you know the travesty of that, the injustice of that.
I'm just concerned, Andy, that during the Cold War, America tended to try and differentiate itself from everything the Russians were doing, all the communism, all the scumbaggery, the wholesale slaughter, imprisonment, no free speech, so on and so forth. Endemic corruption. And what I see now is that the United States has turned into the USSA, and there is practically
no
difference.
That's what I hope to reverse and eliminate and correct as President of the United States. Nobody's talking about that. Let me cite one example. Let's say, just take the last how many presidential elections in the United States that you want to take. How many times have we heard the word police brutality in a presidential election campaign in the United States? How many times have we heard the phrase prison reform? How many times have we heard the phraseology de facto state tyranny? I mean, these fundamental issues of justice are never addressed in the presidential election cycle. And the presidential debate is go ahead.
It's funny you should mention that, because I have heard all of these things brought up during presidential debates, and the people that bring those subjects up are dragged out by the guards and never heard from again.
Well, I mean, we've had some independent candidates that have tried to raise them, but this I think is we're at the quickening here of all of this. The self-proclaimed party identification of American voters suggest now that the independents who are willing to vote and correct that now outnumber those who continue to adhere to partisanship of either party. So I think 2016 is going to be a bellwether year in U.S. electoral history for that reason. We are now in a situation where the independents who want to address fundamental issues of abuse of power by the military, by the intelligence community, and the injustices that have occurred, now outnumber those who identify with either the Republicans or the Democrats.
Do you believe that parties themselves should be disbanded? I believe the Founding Fathers indeed talked about the danger of having political parties.
Yes. In fact, they didn't refer so much in the context of use of the word parties. They were concerned about faction. The form of government of consent by the governed was going to be, it was one in which they hoped to have the people nominating and electing the best people in society. It was actually my friend Dr. Tomislav Hahn did a brilliant thesis in history at the University of Southern California, demonstrating that the framers of the U.S. Constitution were beholden to an Athenian doctrine or notion of constitutional government, in which if we had free elections by the consent of the governed, and then the Electoral College became a filter against basically rabble-rousing by factions, that the people operating in their enlightened self-interest would elect the best people to government. And by that, they meant basically the most intelligent, the most constructive, and the most honest people, those that you would trust as a pillar of your community or, you know, allow to babysit your children. So we've lost hold of that Athenian notion because of the corruption of parties. The Republican Party lost its way from being the party of Abraham Lincoln in 1912. That's why Theodore Roosevelt bolted the Republican Party and began the Bull Moose Party, because the Republican Party that year became the party of Wall Street. And what do we see a year later? We saw the creation of the Federal Reserve at Jekyll Island. The Democrats have lost their way because they've moved from being a populist party concerned about fundamental issues of social justice to being basically a quilt of special interests. And neither of those parties represent the, Richard Nixon's silent majority. And that,
I don't
that group
think
has
so
spoken
either.
Into non-voters and voters who identify themselves as independents, and now essentially outnumbers those who remain adherents to both of the major parties. So sure, the framers did not intend our presidential and less for election processes to be controlled by faction, as it's called.
All right. Well, I think we just do need to remove the factions. The only problem with the U.S. Constitution isn't that it was written by Freemasons. It's just that it just doesn't get followed, okay? Abolish all the scumbaggery, as the Constitution prescribes. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown. Accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guests are Bernie Mendez and Andrew Bishago. Andy's going to be running for president in 2016 as an independent. We're talking about police brutality and turning the country around. It occurred to me over the break, Andy, that Bernie hasn't had much to say during this entire episode. And considering the direction of the United States since the installation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, and, of course, the presidential assassination of John F. Kennedy. And moving on from that, getting all the way up to today, where we have the USA is now the USSA. I wanted to get Bernie's perspective, having for many decades been in part directly involved and certainly paying attention to American politics. And I wanted to know, what you see the real problems are, Bernie, with America today, and more to the point, what direction you would like to see the country go.
It's all going to boil down to economics. The economy is fluctuating. The breakup of the Soviet Union, European Common Market, NAFTA. Eventually, all these things are going to settle down and boil down to jobs, keeping people at working, and having an economic plan that's sound enough to stabilize the economies. The economy is not stable. Once we're over this poverty and war thing, and there's a lot less wars now than there were 30 years ago, it's going to boil down to economics, how one runs the country.
And specifically, how would you do that?
We're moving more and more towards socialized economics, socialized medicine. A lot of social programs are taking off. I don't know. I don't have an economic forecast.
Well, I don't know if you need to see the forecast in order to notice that there's a storm coming. You know what I'm saying?
That's true.
Now, Andrew, yourself personally, being a president of the United States would be one hefty thing. And Bernie does, I think, encapsulate that quite well, that there is a vast need for moving away from socialized economics. Would you agree with that?
Well, I mean, essentially, we were under a model of democratic capitalism, which was characterized by non-authoritarian government and private ownership of property. And prior to Obama, we were moving towards fascism, which is characterized by authoritarian government and private ownership of property. And under Obama, we're now moving towards communism, which is defined by authoritarian government and defending public ownership of property or the creation of public goods. First of all, I want to make it clear that I don't support the pattern that was evolving on the right from Ronald Reagan to George W. Bush of fascism, basically of the combination of authoritarian government in defense of the private ownership of property or capital. And I don't think the antidote to that is communism, where we continue to drift towards a tyrannical statist society, not governed by the consent of the governed, but by government insiders wielding abuses of power over individuals and the country itself. I believe we have to move back to the model of democratic capitalism, which is to say liberal, non-authoritarian government, and the private ownership of capital, which I believe is more just to individuals and enterprises than, let's say, socialism, which is not fascism, as Jim Morris has incorrectly stated in his book, Rule by Secrecy. Socialism is more the conditions that existed in Great Britain after World War II, or let's say Swedish socialism, which is where you have liberal, non-authoritarian government attempting to maintain confiscatory tax rates to create public goods. I think the best model of a society is one in which the people govern themselves under liberal, non-authoritarian government, and you defend the private right to capital. Otherwise, people can't internalize the benefits of their own efforts. Now, there are some structural impediments to really doing so, and one of them is inheritance. So we might consider a socialized instrument like a 100% confiscatory inheritance tax so that everybody starts in that liberal competitive model in the same place. Somebody's not rich simply by accident of birth. But my policy instruments for moving back away from totalitarianism of the left or right, or I should say the right or left, now that we have at least supposedly a communist in the White House. I don't believe we do. I believe Barack Obama is farther right than Bill Clinton. I believe he's a lifelong CIA agent who has perpetuated the right-moving policies of his predecessor, George W. Bush, in terms of the abuse of state power utilizing government to help private enterprise under more of a fascist model rather than a communist one. My solution would be my tax proposal. America and the world are in a depression. A depression follows a period of high productivity where enterprises begin to fall out because what they're producing in terms of a good or service is no longer necessary because it's been created and provided. And then jobs start to fall out, and with joblessness, because there comes a lack of liquidity in the economy. People don't have money to spend on goods and services and so forth. That's where we are. We're in a depression. Now, there was a public way of handling that, and there's a private way. The public way would have been for Barack Obama to be more of a communist and increase taxes on the wealthy and then sponsor a set of infrastructure improvement projects, like, let's say, maglev trains linking larger airports around the country. We could have engaged in expanding our airports, linking cities regionally and on an interstate basis with high-speed trains such as exist in Japan and so forth. That's what Theodore Modus was suspecting would happen in the States in his book Predictions, when we finally hit bottom. So we didn't see that public stimulus at the depths of this depression. I think probably the bottom of the trough was maybe the 2008 and 2009 period, a couple of years after the mortgage fiasco. And really, look at the experience of our friends and family members. In this last 5 or 6 years, the average American has not had any discretionary income. It's like everybody and his brother has been gone wanting for, cash in the bank or cash in their pocket. So my approach to what I think Bernie is correctly identifying as the number one plight in the West is to recapitalize the society. And my proposal for that is a radical tax plan in which we would alleviate the individual from the burden of almost all federal, state, and local taxes, and we would raise revenue federally by a 0.5% to 1% tax on withdrawals from federally insured banks. So we would actually essentially fund the public sector of society by taxing the banks and individuals and enterprises using money. That's when money is taken out of the community pool and used to benefit private actors and enterprises. And that's a legitimate, unless we're to revert to the old constitutional model of excise and import, excise taxes, import duties, and so forth, which I don't think is practical to fund the mass society that we have today. The other approach would be to say, okay, where is the point in the economy in which individuals spend money on themselves and their companies? It's when they withdraw money from banks. And so I would tax at that place in the economy, and that would basically ignite an economic recovery of an unprecedented magnitude. In fact, after several years of that tax scheme being implemented, that tax scheme would start enriching individuals so that we would ultimately move towards a more socialist society under a privatized model. Anyway, that's my proposal, and I urge people to consider it, because I think that would literally end the depression. And it would end the pernicious effect of taxation on the individual. I mean, I acknowledge that there are great social needs that are unmet. I am basically, by predilection, a Washington Democrat, okay? I'm also sort of a Kennedy-Reagan aficionado in the sense that I think both John Kennedy and Ronald Reagan recognized that it is more productive and beneficial for somebody to earn a salary from a private employer than receive a transfer benefit from the government. Socialism doesn't work because there's no money in it. Okay, we saw that in the Eastern Bloc, where it didn't matter if you were a Polish coal miner. I mean, you could sit down on your shovel because you still received a salary for supposedly mining coal, right? So socialism doesn't work because the individuals are paid even when they don't provide their labor to the common good. So what we need to do is we need to incentivize people's economic performance. That's a good aspect of capitalism. But we have to allow people to do that by not taxing the hell out of them at the same time to meet governmental needs. And my tax plan is a way to do that.
Now, in terms of taxation, I had an idea that would be, I'm not sure if it's ever been implemented before in history, but voluntary taxation. Like if you actually did have extra money and you wanted to give it away to certain government projects and so on and so forth, you know, just send them a checklist. This is the items that we want your money to go towards. Itemized taxation, where citizens who pay taxes actually get a report every year about what their money is being spent on and hold it to account and choose to withdraw their money from certain funding operations if necessary. Of course, this would be really huge, really complicated, and the answer is obviously it really can't be done because at the end of the day, what I'm talking about is having individuality control the collective rather than the collective controlling individuality.
Well, you raise a very good point. With 59% of the federal budget going to defense spending, everybody who opposes war, every pacifist or conscientious objector, is forced to pay their taxes and dishonor the profound values that they hold, literally fund that which they morally object to. So I would favor some itemization, for example, to opt out of defense spending because it involves the taking of human life, which some people find morally objectionable, and I think quite rightly. I think they're the sanest people on the planet are the pacifists. But the problem with voluntary taxation is the free rider problem. And that's a problem of charitable giving, and that is that those who are motivated to be generous are taken advantage of by those who are not so motivated or who are avowedly selfish and greedy. So we need an equitable tax plan. I think the key is we need to basically synthesize the dynamic privatized model that the right presents with the compassionate, goal-focused objectives of the left. In other words, both are holding part of the puzzle. The right recognizes that a privatized model is more dynamic and less tyrannical to the individual and to groups and enterprises. But the left recognizes that in an advanced society, we need to have substantial government funding meet those needs that individuals cannot address individually, as Abraham Lincoln observed. So we need to synthesize those two models and say, wait a minute, we need substantial government spending, but we should take it from individuals in the least costly, the least burdensome way, so that sort of under the game theory that the modern economy is, you're empowering people to spend money, not beggaring them so they have to work until May 1st to have the money to do anything dynamic in the model that you're implementing. And so I believe
Let's talk about money itself. Yeah, well, the problem is, Andy, that the private Federal Reserve Bank makes all the money, and they also incidentally created the IRS. If there was only one tax, as you say, with the 1% or so on of financial transactions, what would the Federal Reserve be doing in all of this? Would it be abolished and currency go back to being regulated by Congress or what? Because well, the IRS would almost have no reason to exist if there was only one tax scheme as opposed to the... how many different tax laws are there? 7 million? Something like that? I'm just making it up off the top of my head. I'm probably just giving it a low estimate here. How many different types of taxation are there?
Sorry, the American people would pay off their debt to the Fed, and then the Fed could be basically dissolved. it's not going to be dissolved as long as there is a public debt to the private banking system. So when you recapitalize the economy with my model of a one-half to 1%, one-half of 1% to a 1% tax on bank withdrawals, individuals, basically the public would have the capital to pay off the federal debt and eliminate the Fed. Before that point, there's not going to be a systemic support within government or economists to eliminate the Fed as long as a profound debt, a large debt, is owed by the public to the Fed. So,
or until such a time as the Fed has actually been audited and the Congress actually knows what it is that it's dealing with. Andrew Bruschago and Bernard Mendez are my guests. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, after the break at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. Please donate or subscribe for $5 a month if you can. Back in a minute. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the most operatic 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guests are Andrew Bruschago and Bernie Mendez, former Chrono Nauts. Now, I also wonder as well, Andy, if we're talking about the legislative process, electing a new president of the United States, how exactly can that one person change all of these things? Because what I've noticed, at least in New Zealand anyway, is that when the new leader comes in, the new leader simply gets dominated by all the existing bureaucrats that don't get voted out because they've got jobs, they're there, people in Treasury and so on and so forth. They simply become the new panel of advisors, and they continue to control the government, and the president simply becomes a figurehead. What kind of... has this occurred to you, or do you have some kind of a protocol of getting over that hump?
It's essentially a necessary defect of the American model. I mean, recall the fact that President Kennedy, a Democrat, had the kind of proactive administration that I would seek to implement, but was often stymied by a Democratic Congress. So it is a problem. I think we'd have to fill the cabinet with highly effective, independent individuals. But again, the legislative obstacles to these kinds of changes is the greatest. But what other model do we have? So I guess generous use of the veto power would be one tool that I could implement. But it does concern me because, you know, we look back and recognize what Kennedy achieved as president, but we forget that he was often locked by members of his own party in the Congress. And with that, Vinny, I'm going to have to go because I have to consult with my technical specialist about getting my laptop up and running so I can continue to communicate.
Well, we only have about 9 minutes left on the broadcast, Andy.
Oh, I see. Okay, well, I'll continue then. But okay. No, that's a major problem, and yet we don't have... We're really caught between two failed models. A failed privatized model that hasn't employed Americans nor enriched them, made them wealthy, and a democratic model that doesn't address their needs either. So hopefully the first administration to actually again serve the interests of the American majority would be one in which there would be a major fight with Congress, and then during the midterm elections you'd have a host of independents voted in to start implementing public policies that actually fundamentally advantage the American majority rather than either corporations on the right or special interests on the left. So that first 2 years of any independent presidency, whether it's under myself or Governor Ventura or some person to emerge, is going to be an ugly 2 years in light of the systemic opposition by a Congress that has been captured by corporate and special interests.
If they've been captured precisely what is the mechanism by which they've been captured. And if that is the case, then surely, just like they've been captured and put in a prison cell, which forces what they can and cannot do, there must be a way to open that cell and let them out.
Well, one thing we know that we know has been used beyond just the pressure of lobbyists and the revolving door from government service into corporate employment, which has been used as an indirect form of bribery. It's clear that insider trading has been used as a current indirect form of bribery. In other words, one where the benefit is not protracted into the future, but is implemented immediately when corporate secrets are revealed to members of Congress. They make advantageous investments, and they're actually individually benefited by the insider information they're given. What I was told by Courtney Hunt to the CIA when Bernie and I were back being trained in 1980 in the Jump Room program, and then later, I remained in touch with Courtney for roughly 20 years between 1981 and 2001, is that going into 2015, there was going to be a large payola scandal in which hundreds of members of Congress were going to be identified essentially as CIA agents with Swiss bank accounts. Now, I'm not predicting that. I'm just relaying a career CIA officer statement that, based on its knowledge of the future, the intelligence community was aware that its meddling in Congress was at some point going to lead to a national scandal that would cause an independent group of candidates and president, vice president, cabinet officials to come into possession of the executive branch, to come into those offices, not possession, but those sacred trusts as a result of a huge payola scandal. So that's what something like that, I think, is what we should be looking for coming into 2015. Bernard, I'd like to ask Bernie whether he has any knowledge of just how wealthy Barack Obama was when he ran in 2008. That's an interesting story that I'm sure your listeners deserve to hear.
Well, how wealthy was he? Andy, are you there?
I'm here. Well, I was gonna throw that out to Bernie, but what Bernie had told me was as a result of basically stealing money as a paymaster for CIA and working through his brother with Swiss bank accounts, that at the time he ran in 2008, Barack Obama already had a net worth of about $1 billion. So maybe the payola scandal will begin with an investigation of just how wealthy the president was at the time that he ran for president after serving for 147 days in the Senate. But what Hunt was describing was something far more systemic, in which the American people would literally demand that independent candidates be elected president and vice president and so forth, and into the various Senate and House positions, because the entire Congress would be besmirched by a payola scandal in which it was clear that they were not so much the puppets of lobbyists, but of the intelligence community, that the intelligence community had actually infiltrated elective government and would ultimately be discredited in a huge scandal. So,
but
is not the intelligence
community got an awful lot of private money in it, though?
Well, one wonders how much of that private money is actually compensation from the intelligence community for doing its bidding. I mean, we have the example of every congressional district, no matter how it's gerrymandered, geographically speaking, still always has a major military base in it. That might be an important clue. You know, with 59% of the federal budget going to the military-industrial complex, with a major military base in every congressional district, with an unwillingness of presidents to risk assassination by stepping up and challenging that inordinate control of government by the military and defense contractors, I think something like what Hunt described may be what leads to the great disaffection by 2015 that causes independent voices to come in 2016 and 2020.
Well, let's hope that it can be done. My personal problem with it is merely the conflicts of interest that are, I think they're getting to the point where they're totally systemic. You know, the person with control over the money is, say, the chairman of the Fed. And the Fed ensures that the money supply problems never get corrected, because if they did, they'd run out of profits from this money that they make up out of thin air and charge everybody interest on, which they don't print, so you can't ever pay them back.
Right, right. He was describing something far more scandalous, basically, something in which those who stood for Senate and House positions would know at the time they ran that they would be covertly compensated to do the bidding of the intelligence community prior, after winning. So he's describing something far more in the area of de facto scandal, and not just the sort of the ordinary corruption of government through bribery or privilege, holding a privileged position, or possessing insider information, but something in which literally 300 members of Congress or more would be outed as CIA agents. Pure and simple. And I'm not predicting that, but I think something of that magnitude could certainly tip the political situation in the United States towards widespread support for independent candidates. That would be the only solution to that, short of a civil war. And I don't think the American people would want to fight a civil war against basically an armed insurrection against the government, not a civil war. So short of a paramilitary uprising by the disaffected, I think the disaffected would, given the resources in the United States, human and otherwise, would much more likely agree to elect to office an independent group of candidates who had never served before. That would be the only commonsensical solution short of an armed insurrection. So something like that was predicted by the CIA going back decades, and some of that information reached me when I was serving in the Jump Room program.
Okay. Well, we've run out of time, unfortunately, Andy. Well, considering you used to be a time traveler, I think we'll go back and repeat it on a future show. The element I feel is the most important when it comes to the United States is recognizing where the intelligence community, and that's basically for more or less running the country right now, the historical evidence shows that intelligence communities were always set up by royal families and monarchs, so on and so forth, to protect their interests by knowing what's going on inside their empires, which they own for as long as humanly possible. I wonder whose interests the CIA, NSA, the TSA, the FBI, and so on and so forth, all the way down the line to the Department of Defense and the rest of the military and industrial complex. Who are the people that they serve? Who are the creators of this apparatus that is being set up? We'll talk about that next time. Andrew Brashago, thank you very much. Bernard Mendez, thank you too. ProjectPegasus.net is the website, and we'll see you again sometime later, gentlemen, at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com.